Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Vassals of Kingsgraves, Agatha Christie reread. My name is Bina 007, and I'll be your host today for our 18th episode. We'll be covering Death in the Clouds, aka Death in the Air, published originally in 1935. I'm so pleased for this gorgeous and Hercule Poirot and Spectre Jack mystery that I'm joined by Hannah.
Hello, it's Winged Shadow from the forums. And I'm feeling very English today as it is overcast and quite chilly and wet.
same exact weather over here, Hannah. And by Xander.
Hello, it's Xander, the Lord Baron. And despite it snowing the other day, it is 15 and sunny today.
Oh, well, I'm glad to have you guys with me. And Xander, we're back with a proper through and through Hercule Poirot mystery. Death in the Clouds is often not seen as one of the kind of classic, you know, top of the line Agatha Christie's, but I found as I was rereading this, and I haven't read it in about 20 years, that I was actually very locked into the intricacies of the plot. I really enjoyed it. Xander, you've never read it before. How did you find this detective story?
Honestly, this is probably the one that least sucked me in out of all of them so far.
It has that reputation.
Wow, really?
Because I did like the characters and I got less interested in the mystery. Ooh. And everything that was going on. It was just at this point, I'm so dialed into Christie's characters that now that's what I'm looking forward to rather than the mysteries.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, interesting take. So that's interesting because we're going to come at it from a different angle when we get into the character discussion. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm sorry you didn't enjoy it as much, though. Don't worry, we've got a hum. I'm scared now of overhyping ABC Murders.
No, there's a really good one coming. Don't worry.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really good because it's Hastings, it's Jap, it's
I think
Poirot.
Especially given what he just said.
Yeah, characters are amazing. Yeah, exactly. How about you, Hannah?
I have never read this one before.
Oh,
this one
okay.
Has skipped my goes. So I liked it. I didn't like it at first. I don't necessarily care a great deal for the end, but I did like the middle. I thought the middle was fun. And I definitely didn't know. I had no clue. I had some suspicions, but I didn't know. I didn't solve it. And there's a lot of fascinating cultural stuff about the time period that I think we get in this one, where we don't really get in such other books, as like Parallel End House is sort of self-contained, right? There's certain things here and there, and they go to the hospital at one point, but it's very isolated among one class and one location, whereas Death in the Clouds kind of spans a lot more. And I think it comes out in the writing more for me this time. Maybe it's just that I never caught it before, but to me, I felt like there was a lot more like these throwaway cultural references that were very specific to the 30s, and especially being an English woman in the 30s, that, you know, I would catch myself wanting to stop and then look it up. And there's a lot of stuff that I did look up about aviation back then to check the accuracy. So I have a ton of notes on what I think this Universal Airlines and the Prometheus was in real life.
Cool. Okay, well, we'll definitely get into that. I do think there's something really lovely and luxurious about the fact that Agatha Christie is, at this point, she's 45, she's very successful. Being a wealthy female writer is tasting some of the luxuries of life, the Orient Express, air travel. We'll get to Death on the Nile as well. And so you get to live a little bit through her lives. And again, I also found it fascinating to see, oh my God, you know, the pioneers of commercial air travel, this is what it was like. Yeah. So let's get into it. And dear listener, as always, we'll talk a little bit about context, the characters, adaptations, how the text has or hasn't held up to modern standards, but all spoiler free. And then after the end credits music, we'll get into the solution, how it compares maybe to other books that we've read in the series, and some of the spoilery stuff. So I'm also going to get into some of the stuff in the end credits about what happens in the two various three-act tragedy versions, the US and UK, because a listener on YouTube very kindly really spelled it out and helped clarify that. So I'll fill you in on that one too. So if you haven't read three-act tragedy, you should probably avoid the spoiler part of this as well. Okay, so let's get into it. We're getting lots of Christie verse overlap. There's a really funny bit where Inspector Japp says, everyone can't have done it. And for those of us who've read our Christie, we know that that refers actually to a case. There's also a bit where the detective in the novel, Clancy, is researching with his Bradshaw's Railway Guide about the 7:55 train from Trabzon. So, you know, clear references to Orient Express. We have a man in the brown suit, and we have Monsieur Giraud, the French inspector, makes a reference to Murder from the Links. So there's some nice little Christieverse stuff going on there. Not as much actually as ABC Murders. That has a lot, but there's a fair amount going on in this one. And let's get into setting in context. So Hannah, how far do you think this novel depicts commercial air travel? Is it accurate?
The very first commercial flight took off from St. Petersburg, Florida on New Year's Day, 1914.
That is so much earlier than I would have expected.
Than I thought.
Yeah.
The man who owned the airline, it was him, I believe, piloting it, and a single passenger took a 20-minute flight around the bay, including one stop, in 1914 on New Year's Day. So that was really something. One thing to keep in mind here that I do feel like is maybe one of the bigger inaccuracies is that most commercial airlines were not pressurized until 1938. The pressurization machine was not installed in most airlines until 1938. So they would have been flying at a very low altitude, under 15,000 feet. They would have had freezing temperatures, a lot of turbulence, and above all things, it would have been extremely loud in the cabin, to the point where the motor of the Tin Goose, or the Ford tri-motor, could be up to 120 decibels. Hearing loss begins to occur at plus 85 dBs over an extended period of time. To put that in perspective, this would be louder than a rock concert. Stewards would use megaphones to interact with passengers.
Commercial flight was also very slow at this time. A flight from New York to Los Angeles could take up to 25 hours. A transcontinental trip could take a week or more and cost in 1930s currency $200, which is almost $10,000 today. And they called them world tours. Most planes would be full of mail more than they were of passengers. Air travel was certainly an activity for the elite. Pan Am's flying boat, the Clipper, also known as a seaplane, they called it that because it could land on water, and it literally had all the amenities you would expect to find aboard a major sea liner like the Titanic, something like the White Star Line. They had separate gender bathrooms, staterooms with bunk beds, separate dining compartments. It was like being on a flying hotel, a flying five-star hotel. The 1930s sees the first metal fuselages. Prior to this, they were made of wood or fabric. The average cruising airspeed is about 100 miles per hour or 160 kilometers per hour before the 1930s, in the decade before, so in the 20s. And then in the 1930s, we see it rise to 200 miles per hour or somewhere around 320 kilometers per hour. Which by today is like nothing. That's, I think they're doing more than that when they're taxiing. Passengers and luggage would be weighed on the tarmac for fuel calculation. Passenger weight is now estimated based on your ID or passport and done automatically for you. And here's where it gets interesting. This is what I believe is the inspiration for Death in the Clouds, although I tried to research exactly and seeing if I could have like a quote of Christy saying this was what her inspiration was. So this is conjecture truly, but I do believe I'm onto something. The giant British airline, the Hanley Page Hannibal, the first of its fleet of the eight largest passenger machines in the world, made its first successful flight in 1932. It was a biplane with four forward mounted prop engines close to the fuselage and two affixed engines on the land. Two were affixed at the leading edge of the top wing. Two were affixed at the leading edge of the bottom wing, wider out. They advertised this as being very far away from the body of the plane to give it a more quiet experience. But if you're able to look at the Hanley Page Hannibal, you'll see that they are very close to the fuselage by our standards. So I'm not sure how much quieter it would have been up there for them. The horizontal tail wing was supported by three vertical stabilizers, each with a rudder at the back. This was Imperial Airways, which was HQ'd in Croydon, UK. It was established in 1924 as a, quote, It represents a British reply to the German challenge for air supremacy and commercial aircraft construction. Fully loaded, it weighed about 13 tons. Its cruising speed was around 105 miles per hour or 170 kilometers per hour. The fixed in place ground gear wheels were about 4 to 5 feet tall. Imperial Air merged with British Overseas Airways Corporation in 1939. And in 1974, that became known as British Airways. So she was probably flying and writing about an airline company that ultimately became British Airways that we know today.
The pictures are nuts when you Google the airplane.
Isn't it?
Because you have the kind of the normal sticky out wings that we're used to. Then this whole like massive through and through like wing, like uni wing that goes across the top. And yeah, these, the three fins at the back are just nuts. It's so fascinating. Right.
Yeah. A vertical stabilizer like that now would not, it wouldn't really work in the altitude that they're getting at in our jets. That wouldn't be, it wouldn't provide enough vertical stabilization. That's why we have those big ones that go way, way, you know, they're 20 feet tall in some cases. I imagine that you would be risking quite a lot of rudder hard over in a situation like this, if the lines that lead all three of these rudders are not redundant.
Yeah.
If one of them were to fail, you know, you could be looking at quite a disaster. And there were several. There were four major disasters with the airline at the time of the publication of her book.
Yeah, I mean, it's really fascinating, isn't it? Because a lot of what you've talked about there is picked up in the book. So, reader, as this book opens, Hercule Poirot is taking a flight from Paris back to London or Croydon, as the airport is here. And you have the motley crew of people on the flight. So effectively, it's a closed door or closed house mystery, just as we had on Murder in the Orient Express, because the only people who can have committed the murder are the people in the airline cabin or maybe the stewards. And so that's the kind of the setup of it. But the whole kind of opening section is phenomenal, because you're just sitting there as a modern person thinking, oh my God, they're eating like a three-course meal on this flight. And what kind of blew my mind is that they're paying for the meal as if in a restaurant for what you ordered, and they have to tip the waiter, almost like tipping the air steward, which kind of blew my mind. Mm-hmm. And then later on, they do mention the noise, actually, how noisy it is and how much the turbulence is getting to poor Monsieur Hercule Poirot's estomach. And Xander, I really thought of you when he's like, with all this turbulence, I'm just reduced to a mere normal person. My brain is not like it's reduced him to mere mediocrity.
I definitely felt him in that.
The whole thing just tickled my fancy. I love this idea of, you know, the romance of the air, and this idea of you've got aristocrats and professional people and this one lady who's won basically the sweepstakes. And it just feels so romantic. But there's so much in this.
Which would be the only way she could afford it.
Yeah, exactly.
It was quite expensive.
What else got me in this book is just technology in general seems so much more advanced, but so much more wondrous. There's a point where Hercule Poirot later on is going to make a trunk long distance call to Canada. And even Hercule Poirot, as rational and little grey cells as he likes to pretend to be, says, quote, "It is romantic, you know, the transatlantic telephone, to speak so easily to someone nearly halfway across the globe." And I was like, they really had long distance calls in those days? That just blew my mind.
Yeah. And then I was thinking about what it was like calling my friend who moved back to Japan in high school, and the like delay and the shitty quality of that on my landline. Yeah. And I'm just thinking, what would a call like that to Canada, number one, what would it cost? And number two, what would the quality be?
There's also another point where Hercule Poirot faxes a photo. And I had no idea you could fax a photo telephonically in those days. That, to me, the fax machine is something from my youth, like from the 1980s. It was new technology, but what do I know?
I know it's always crazy when you go and you look up like sewing machine and you look at the date on when the first like quote unquote sewing machine. And they're talking about something like very primitive to what we use now, but and rare. But still, it's like, you know, the 17th century, it's things like that where you're just like, well, I would have never guessed. And like
the basic technology works the same.
I would have never said that the first commercial flight was in 1914.
Yeah, it blows your mind, right? Absolutely blows your mind. So another interesting cultural references is that up until this point, you know, this is now 1935, and hitherto we've not really heard Agatha Christie refer to the stock market crash or the Great Depression, but it makes a number of references here. Like it starts coming up, and it will come up in other books as well. So she refers, there's a character called Zeropoulos, who's a Greek antique dealer in Paris. And he refers to the fact that because the Americans over there, somewhere over there, they've had a depression. And so he can't fleece them for fake antiques as much as he used to. So that's an interesting little throwaway line.
Yeah, that one really got me. I just never realized that it was so contained to the United States. I just sort of figured, like, obviously they don't have the kind of globalized economy we do now, but I figured there's some spillover, no? And
yeah, I mean, even
really thought that was a factor leading up to World War II.
Me too, especially, like, I really thought that this was a global thing. So maybe, yeah, who knows? I mean, I should know, right? Because I studied economic history, but I really thought it was more global than that. But then there's a really funny thing where Cicely Horbury, Lady Horbury, who's a British aristocrat, you know, they're talking about, you know, she has a very unhappy marriage, but she doesn't want to be divorced because she likes her status. And she's having a conversation with her evil arch enemy, the Honorable Venetia Kerr. No, actually, this is with Hercule Poirot. And she says, there aren't any millionaires anymore. And then Poirot says, well, the man who had 3 million now has 2 million. So they're not, you know, the world's smallest violin, which I thought was quite funny that Agatha Christie via Poirot is not making too much spilled milk and crying tears over people who lost a million in the Great Depression when they still have some millions. But so even for Poirot and for Cicely Horbury, there's obviously this understanding that, that there's less money floating about. And even with the archaeologists, they're saying there's a father and son who are archaeologists on the plane, French archaeologists, and they rely on private fundraising. And they're saying, actually, it's much harder to raise funds anymore. Apparently, Hercule Poirot's wealth is untouched by the Depression, though, because he offers to fund an expedition at the end of the novel. So
so it's sort of like they go from Great Gatsby to P. Diddy's White Party, which we all know is far, far inferior.
Yeah, exactly.
First world problems.
Other little cultural stuff going on in the 1930s. You still have a little bit of P.G. Woodhouse. So the country lawyers are called Fuchs, Wilbraham and Fuchs with double Fs because the aristocracy. I think Agatha Christie loves to make up silly aristocratic names. You have the Lion's Corner House, which was a very big thing, actually. The idea that young women who were single, like the hairdresser who's the star of the story, could just go and eat unaccompanied at a Lion's Corner House was quite a big social kind of revolution and quite sort of liberating that you didn't have to be chaperoned. You could just go and eat yourself. But divorce is still seen as socially undesirable and a bit sort of, gosh, if we can avoid it, we should. So, you know, we've got the liberation of women in one sense, but in the other sense, kind of social mores are still quite, I guess, restrictive. Let's get into characters. Xander, who was your favorite, if any, because maybe the not having the good characters, I don't know. You tell me, who did you love on the plane?
Honestly, I quite like Jane Grey. I think, again, it's just, you know, Agatha Christie kind of inserting herself in a, like, almost a youthful fantasy experiment kind of thing, you know, like, oh, if I were this young again, what if I acted this way, how would it work out kind of stuff. And I feel like you can actually, like, really see that.
I can completely agree, and I think a lot of her characters, when she started to make money, they're often like 10 years younger than her, but people who've almost by accident come into money and then are just enjoying the luxurious pleasures of life. And you can see the similarity with Catherine Grey in Murder on the Blue Train, who comes into an inheritance and then books herself on a luxurious train on holiday to the South Coast. There's a kind of joy of being kind of like a hardworking middle-class girl who's like, oh, I'm suddenly on a plane and it's so romantic and I'm going to Paris. And yeah, I think it's really lovely to make her the point of view because she's kind of our sort of avenue into this kind of world of aristocrats and other people, I guess. Anyone else you liked or didn't like as a character?
I mean, obviously Poirot. He's always so much fun. I don't know. Everybody else is kind of, it's not that they're boring, but it's a very familiar character she's written before, just with different names and slightly different backgrounds.
Yeah, I agree. There's a little bit of sameness. I really like the two women. I think she writes great women.
She absolutely does, yeah.
Jane Grey's smart and she's resourceful, and she, you know, she's part of the action, part of the detection team, which I love. But you also have Lady Cicely Horbury, who I think is really funny. Well, not really funny, but I think quite tragic in some ways. But she's obviously this very pretty woman who has married an aristo but doesn't like him very much. And she's got a gambling addict. She probably has a bit of a cocaine habit. So a very modern character in some respects. But she's kind of like quite bitchy towards Venetia Kerr, the Honourable Venetia Kerr. And then Venetia Kerr's quite bitchy back. And I just think there's something really honest about the way Agatha Christie writes female rivalry. Like, it's really unashamed.
Agreed, yeah.
And they just like, they sit there, you get on the first scene on the plane, you kind of get their interior monologues, and they're just so mean and bitchy about each other. It's hilarious. Like, basically, Venetia Kerr is saying of the Countess of Horbury, like, bloody little tart. Her cloak, you know, it's like, she's like, oh yeah, she's just this sort of like slapper, this slut who's married this like guy who I love, who's an aristo, who's worth more than her. And it's just really harsh, but really, I think, true to how, maybe not just women, right, but just how people, if they're honest, can think about other people who are their rivals. So I kind of like that honesty. I thought that was quite fun to read. Hannah, any favorite characters we haven't mentioned, or anyone else? Otherwise, I will go through the rest of the characters.
Well, I will say, and perhaps this should be saved for the spoiler section, but I did have a hard time finding myself liking any of the characters because I couldn't figure it out who they were. So I really wanted to like Jane Grey, but I really thought she might have done it for a lot, like most of the book. I was like pretty convinced, like, this is all a ruse. And like, poor Rose just keeping her close, you know, like, well, that kind of thing.
He does say, I kept you close for a long time.
Yeah. So I did like Mr. Clancy, though. I'm like, how can he not? He's just such a scatterbrain and sort of the comic relief. And then even though this is one with Inspector Japp, we get a lot of Monsieur Fournier in this. And I like that. He's kind of a good sidekick, kind of a very strong, sobering presence to Poirot. I think they're like very like-minded. So he's very validating for Poirot in a way that like Japp and Hastings normally aren't. So I enjoyed that dynamic greatly. But yeah, Mr. Clancy is probably hands down my favorite.
So let's run through the characters. So we've got on the plane, you've got Hercule Poirot. Basically spends most of the flight just like in suffering from, you know, turbulence or asleep, and doesn't really see what's going on. You've got Jane Grey, who is a young hairdresser in a stylish Mayfair salon. She's just won the Irish sweepstake, and she's a working class woman, right? She's worried for being mixed up in the murder. She thinks it might lose her business. People won't want to be associated with her, but she's got a lot of common sense, and she likes the adventure. And then we have Norman Gale, who is a dentist. They actually meet. They've been in the south of France at a gambling resort called Le Pinay. And he's meant to be very good looking. Although I love Gladys, who is Jane Grey's best friend, who says anyone can have a brown face. It may come from the seaside, or it may have come out of a bottle, 2 shillings and 11 pence at the chemist's. Handsome men are slightly bronzed, says Gladys. I was kind of surprised that there were like fake suntans in those days, actually, come to think of it, of things that were ahead of their time. Then that men were known to like affect bronze skin. Hilarious.
I mean, I guess they used to do it with white.
Yeah, so why not, right?
Powdered wigs and shit.
Yeah, so the Countess of Horbury, a coked up gambling addict who hates Venetia Kerr. Actually, later on, one of the characters will say of her quite bitchily, but I think quite well, I know her type well. You see it sitting around the baccarat table, the soft face, the hard expression, and 15 years. She lives for sensation, that one, for high play, perhaps for drugs. So the idea that she's a little bit past her prime and that hard living is taking its toll. We get Honourable Venetia Kerr, who's proper old money, sort of Downton Abbey, Lady Mary style. The same guy says of her, her clothes are very well cut, but rather like a man. In my head, Venetia Kerr looks like Katharine Hepburn. She walks about as though she owns the earth. She's not conceited about it. She's just an Englishwoman. And I think this is Agatha Christie being very good at like piercing the snobbery of upper class English people. She knows which department of England different people come from. It is true, I've heard ones like her in Egypt. What the et ceteras are here? The Yorkshire et ceteras or the Shropshire et ceteras? And it is, it's very much that kind of like, oh, I know the County set, I know the Aristos. And you can see that even today. Like, I know people like that. And I think Agatha Christie is really wonderful because she makes her heroine the working class hairdresser and makes and really takes the piss out of the snobbery of the Aristos. And I like that she's very socially satirical, I guess. We have a Mr. Ryder who's having trouble in business. You've got Dr. Bryden who's on the plane and can go to the murdered victim. We have Mr. Clancy, who Hannah says she loves, the detective writer. He actually owns a blowpipe and knows about curare for research. He eats a lot of bananas. very chaotic, but also actually highly perceptive and observant. And this is the first of the detective characters that Agatha Christie is going to include in her novels as a meta narrative on herself. And she'll later have a character called Ariadne Oliver, who's even more kind of Agatha Christie-ish, except she will be addicted to apples. So I think Agatha Christie, it shows her like increasing confidence that she feels that she can start almost satirizing herself as a world famous detective. And then, as I said before, you've got the DuPonts, they're French archaeologists. The son has an attractive boyish personality. And then last but not least, we have Madame Giselle, the moneylender, who is scrupulously honest, incredibly rich, a powerful businesswoman and a public figure. Like, people know who she is. And she makes her living lending money to maybe famous aristocrats or stars who want discreet money lending. And she always gets paid back because she always holds information on the people that she lends to and will threaten to release it if they don't pay her back. But once they do pay her back, she destroys it. So she does play fair. We know that she lost her looks to smallpox. And she is the murder victim on the plane. So as the plane is traveling from Paris to London, at some point there's a wasp in the plane that seems to distract people. And then they find that they think she's asleep when it comes to pay the stewards for the meal. And then it looks like a wasp has maybe stung her on her neck and that she's died from that. But then Hercule Poirot, perceptive, realizes there's a little kind of blowpipe dart at her feet, and that a blowpipe is then found actually tucked into Hercule Poirot's seat. So people are saying, oh my goodness, what if someone blew a poison dart at her in the air carriage? And Hercule Poirot is obviously deeply affronted that he could come under suspicion. So he resolves to solve the crime of why Madame Giselle, the moneylender, would be murdered. So that sets up the mystery. And I think it's a really cool one. We'll get into the solution in the spoiler section, boys and girls.
I will say that this part is accurate. So security was nowhere near like it was today in the 1930s. From arriving at the airport to being on your plane and taking off could sometimes take as little as 10 minutes. They would not search bags of people. They would just weigh them to make sure that they had enough fuel to carry them wherever they were going, so they couldn't be overweight with their fuel consumption. That would be the only thing that they would check at the airport.
There's a lot of classic Poirot here. Xander, some other moments I was really thinking of you. At one point, Norman Gale, the dentist, says to Poirot, "You cannot know that." And Poirot says, "Mon cher, practically speaking, I know everything." Oh, love that guy.
Classic.
So flipping classic Poirot.
I also just love the revelation that the blowpipe was stuffed under his seat, and him and what's his name, Jap, and he's like, "Surely, you know, you didn't do this. This isn't your work." And he's like, "If it was, this isn't how I would do it." You know, it was just so good.
I flippin' love that guy. There is one moment, as he's described, I think, by Christie, as exquisitely dressed in the most dandyical style. And I know what like dressing like a dandy or being dandified is, but the word dandyical style I thought was so good. And it's something they really get in the David Suchet TV adaptations, where he's always dressed very fussy. How do you feel about Inspector Poirot, Papa Poirot, as we're now getting to know him? Does love to put couples together at the end of books. He likes to see everyone well settled. How do you feel about the fact that at some point he basically gives the archaeologists a bunch of money on the condition that they give Jane Grey a job? I mean, without asking her if she wants to be working on an archaeological dig. I mean, it's a pretty high-handed way of going about things, Xander. Or do you still love him regardless?
No, I think he's a romantic in all aspects. I mean, he may only know private investigating, but he's still trying to do the right things.
Yeah, he has a very conservative kind of socially, like, he wants to see couples happily married. And yeah, he is quite sweet in that way. But I was just like, how, like, he just literally sold off Jane Grey to a bunch of archaeologists? What the hell? Which probably segues us nicely into how the text holds up to a modern reader. And I have to say, not always, some books are better than others. There were a lot of pretty nasty points. You know, a lot of talk about curare being employed by the natives. Jack calls the DuPonts seedy little Frenchmen. At one point, one of the students says, foreigners, you can't trust foreigners, even if they are the police.
There's a lot of anti-foreigner sentiments in this one.
Particularly amongst the working class, which I think probably true of the time.
Which is crazy because didn't they just fight with the French against the Italian in World War One? So
I know, but still foreign.
It was very awkward for me.
I know. Henry the Steward says, who's to know what reason foreigners have for murdering each other? And if you ask me, I think it's a dirty trick to have done in a British aeroplane.
Right.
Like, God forbid someone died, but, you know, did they have to do it on a British aeroplane?
Right.
And then I think this is a real sign of the time, like the rising threat of communism and Stalin. Like, his wife says, if you ask me, there's Bolsheviks at the back of it. And I thought, this is like flipping McCarthyism in the States after the war, isn't it? Like, anything dodgy goes on must be communists.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
It is so dodgy. But I think here, Christie is satirizing those people. I don't think she shares that opinion, but it is pretty pervasive. But anyway, let's get to the nastier bit, because there are nastier bits. Jean works as a hairdresser, and he pretends to be a French hairdresser called Antoine, but, quote, his only claim to foreignness is being half Jewish, end quote. I think when you think of what's going on in Germany in this year, in 1935 and in this period, and you see that even in England, just by being Jewish, you're not really English, are you? Because you're actually Jewish, you're other. I think that's kind of pretty sad to read in a mainstream book that was hugely popular. So evidently must have represented what a lot of people felt like. And then it's really nasty when Jean she becomes very popular in the hair salon because people want to have their hair done by this woman who's caught up in a salacious murder. And she asks Andrew for a rise, the Jewish guy, for a rise. And it's insinuated kind of like that typical anti-Semitic thing that Jewish people are tight. And one of the other hairdressers refers to him as, quote, Ike Andrew, end quote, which is a really old-fashioned but pejorative term for Jewish people, which, I don't know, when I read that, I mean, I haven't read the word Ike in print or heard someone use that as an insult for a very long time, and it was just really horrible.
Is it like a shortened version of the K word?
Ike, I think it's like, yeah, it's, yeah, but definitely, yeah,
when that part came up, I was like, what does this have to do with Dwight D. Eisenhower? You know what? We like Ike.
Oh, well, bless you for, bless you for
not. I didn't understand it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, basically, I think Ike is short as a nickname for Isaac, and therefore it's like calling, when a lot of English people can pejoratively refer to Irish people as Paddies, because a lot of them are called Patrick, so nicknamed Paddy, but it's not meant in a nice way. It's meant in a kind of, oh, it's another Paddy. Like, it's, so I think that's kind of.
Oh, you know, or like, he's a Mick.
Yeah, exactly. But like, totally, totally not in a nice way. But anyway, this is, so the reason, Xander, that I think I have, like, you know, I read these books, I know they're from a century ago, so, and I still love reading them, and I value them for what they show us about that period, and I never really noticed phrases like this getting in the way of me loving a character. But I really struggled with this book and the characters, because I think I don't get on with Jean Grey, even though she's smart and amazing, because there's this passage where she's having a date, effectively, with the dentist, Norman Gale, And Agatha Christie says it's this amazing date. And we've all had first dates like this, right? Where you meet someone and suddenly you realize that you like the same TV shows and you hate the same music and you love the same music. And every, you know, it's like you agree and disagree and everything. Like, finally, I have someone who gets me and understands me. And then she has this phrase: they disliked loud noises, noisy restaurants, and Negroes. They preferred buses to tubes. And it's the way that, like, liking Black people could be something that is a taste that you could have equivalent to, hey, I like Mozart and I hate Negroes. And it was just the idea that they would bond on this hot first date over their hatred of Black people. And I think when I read that, I kind of lost love for Jean Grey and I never kind of got it back. And I don't think I really got it back for the book, although I appreciated its plot. So I don't know. I know all the books have racism in them, but, or some of them do, but this one, I found it harder to get over this one. And I think it's because it was used as a bonding thing rather than just an insult, if that makes sense. I don't know.
No, I agree. And like, so obviously it's something like that's always shocking to read. And I'm by no means any like declarative voice on this, but when, like, especially reading Agatha Christie, because you're right, there is, like, every book there's racism.
Yeah.
But to me, not only is it written 100 years ago, but it's also by a very well-off British woman, you know.
Yeah, height of colonial power. All
things I cannot relate to, because, like, a lot of the way I kind of go through life is, like, I'm an ignorant American from Chicago. So, like, I don't know. It's Chicago is one of the biggest melting pots for me, or in my mind, you know. So, like, a lot of times when I come across things like this, I always assume it's because people don't see how I see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in a way, I think that's the power of books like these, right? Because, A, they're so enjoyable in their own right. Or maybe this one's slightly less than the previous one for Xander, but... And even for me, actually, I didn't enjoy this much as the last one. But in general, they hold up, right? And they're really good reads. But they do just, they just show you, like, even reading George R.R. Martin from 20 years ago just shows you a little bit kind of how we all thought without even thinking about it. Okay. And as Sandra said, you know, this is a very wealthy woman from a very, you know, from England at the height of its power, right? As a colonial nation. So evidently there are going to be attitudes. And in a way, what I find refreshing is that she could be horrific. Like, there's a lot of people you read in this period, height of Imperial England, like John Buchan and other really mainstream famous authors of the time, who are way worse, who are, like, really, really horrific. And actually, I think you just have to also, as much as, like, talking about what is negative, you have to really appreciate the positive. And like, right. I said, this kind of, her characters weren't all posh aristos. She really has a lot of working class heroines. And that was radical. You know, you think of Sherlock Holmes and all these other famous detectives, you know, they were aristos. They were well-funded, and like Lord Peter Wimsey. But Hercule Poirot is just a common or garden working policeman, like a working class policeman who came, as we learned in the last book, from a very poor family, who through his own intelligence and hard work has achieved a position of wealth. And it's really commendable, right? It's really meritocratic. So I think there are things. And also, you know, even I was thinking of the dead woman, Madame Giselle, the moneylender, is kind of like a really admirable character in a way, to be a powerful businesswoman, to have conducted her business scrupulously. You know, these are cool characters to have created in the time. So anyways, let's get into the adaptations, because there's some fun stuff here. There is a 1992 edition of the Agatha Christie Poirot, the TV series that we've referenced many times, starring David Suchet as Hercule Poirot. And it's really handsomely made. They really do the playing very well. They actually do get the Handley. No, they don't have a Handley Page HB 42. They actually get a Douglas DC-3 because they couldn't find a Handley Page HB 42, which is a bit of a shame. But anyway, they do try to recreate the plane, which is cool. It's very faithful. So if you want to watch a really faithful version, I would highly recommend it. It's good
fun. Now, wait a second. Is this the one that starts when they're in France and they go to the tennis match?
Absolutely. So in a lovely little...
So I started watching it, but I couldn't get past it because I'm like, no, we open up on the casino.
No, they go
I watched
see Fred
like 15
Perry.
Minutes of it and turned it off.
They go and see Fred Perry winning the French Open, which I think is really cool. But no, after that, if you have got past it, it's incredibly faithful. So
okay, I'll give it another go around.
Give it another go. And then I listened to the John Moffat radio play. So you've recommended these all through the series. Hannah, and for the first time I actually listened to it, and it was just absolutely amazing. I love the way they do.
Aren't they great?
The sound effects and just the whole atmosphere. It's just really, really lovely. So I'm now going to try and listen to the radio plays going forward because I really enjoyed it. And again, very, very faithful, but quite concise. I mean, the way they kind of distill it down, I think is really impressive. So
yeah, the ABC Murders one is really great.
Yeah,
really, can't really wait. Good stuff.
Can't wait to do it. So that's the adaptations. Talked a little bit about the characters. We're now going to sign off, dear listener. So I don't know if we would wholeheartedly recommend this one. I think we all liked bits of it and didn't like other bits of it. I think it is, most people would say it's like second tier Agatha Christie, second tier Poirot. But if you've not read it and you're looking for a new Poirot to read, then it's worth having a go. It's not terrible by any means. It's just not in sort of, you know, first draw.
Yeah, I don't think it cracks like the top 10.
No, for me. But it's definitely mid-table, I think.
But it is fun, you know.
Yeah.
There's a lot of fun to it.
And there's lots of really fun social stuff in there. So definitely, definitely worth a go. So anyway, goodbye, dear reader. And we will maybe join you in the spoiler bit after the break. So now we can get into whodunit, and it's probably worth talking a bit about three-act tragedy, which is what we discussed in the last episode, because a lovely listener, maybe the only listener on YouTube.
I have a note about this, actually.
Yeah, kindly wrote a comment and said the difference between the UK and the US edition is that in the US edition, there's no kind of previous wife who is preventing a divorce and therefore remarrying, because the divorce laws, I guess, are different in the US. So they didn't think that would be plausible. He's just a more psychopathically motivated murderer in the US edition. So the motive is very different. So I thought I'd clear that up because I clearly didn't know what the hell I was talking about in the last episode. Hannah, do you have a note to add?
Oh, just that in chapter 7 of Death and the Clowns, there is a reference to three-act tragedy. Hercule Poirot says that his killer used a psychological moment to commit the crime.
Yeah, which is very good. But the biggest giveaway, I think, when you know the plot, so whodunit was Norman Gale. We realized that actually, of all the suspects that Poirot was considering on the plane, and he does say at one point, well, no one really thinks of the stewards, they think of the actual passengers. And we realized that Norman Gale had his dentist coat in his briefcase. Why would he have that? And he had an empty matchbox. So he was keeping the wasp in the matchbox to release in the flight to cause a distraction. And he went to the back of the plane, put on his dentist coat and a bit of cotton wool in his cheeks to impersonate a steward, put an extra teaspoon on Madame Giselle's saucer and then sort of killed her while he was doing that, because no one suspects the servants. And if you've read three-act tragedy and you know that Sir Charles Cartwright impersonated a butler kind of to do the same thing because no one suspects a servant, you actually realise that it's basically a very similar means of murder and that she's kind of working out the same idea again. And we also know, because we've been reading Christie a lot, that we never trust servants or actors.
Right.
So with that in mind,
I didn't pick up on that at all, but I did from the get-go. I was like screaming at the audiobook. They didn't use the damn blowpipe. Like that part I saw coming a mile away, that it wasn't that the blowpipe was actually used. It was inserted by hand. It was from this second one. I knew the blowpipe was a red herring.
But I think it plays fair, right? Because we, of all the evidence that we hear lots of people give evidence, but we never hear Norman Gale give evidence. He talks about how Poirot can't be a detective because he doesn't do disguises. So we're alerted to the fact that disguise could be part of it. On page 60 in my edition, which is a 300-page book, so quite early on, Jack already says that if the murder victim had a daughter, and if the daughter had been on the plane, she'd be suspected of killing her mum for the fortune. And I think, you know, the more you read in Agatha Christie, the more you realize it's usually that you've got to follow the money. Like it's usually pretty straightforward when you try and figure out, you know, who did the murder benefit. And if there's no
I
one
was really up until the very end, I was very on the track of like Jane Grey got into debt with her somehow and was gambling to sort of repay it. I was like very much again, I keep coming back to like Nick
in End House.
But
so
I, think, like,
I was pleasantly surprised it wasn't her.
Yeah. And once we realized she's got a daughter who's now grown up, I think you're meant to suspect the young women. So I think you're meant to suspect Jean Grey. Xander, did you have any strong convictions as you went through, or were you just along for the ride?
So funnily enough, this is actually the first one I think I figured out.
Wow. Really?
Yeah. Sure. So the book edition I have has a wasp on the cover.
Yeah, so does mine.
So does my audiobook.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, so I was, you know, as I'm reading it, I'm like, fucking wasp, and the wasp comes up, and I'm like, oh, that's, the wasp is a red herring. This is nothing. What the fuck is this, you know? And then I think what kind of made me figure it out was when Poirot checks the lists, and it's the dentist coat that kind of really tips it over.
And listened to that three times and I to pick up on what he was looking for, and I didn't get it. Good for you.
You got it from the dentist coat.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good for you. Wow. That's amazing.
Because there's a point where Poirot says, I basically figured it out from the contents of all the briefcase bags.
But he doesn't say what.
Maybe it's better if you can see it.
And I did what you did, Hannah. I went back and looked at the list.
Yeah.
And bear in mind,
I thought about looking it up and looking at a physical list, and I didn't. And I thought about trying to write it down, and I didn't. Maybe I should have. But yeah, good job, Xander.
Wow. Because I knew that the blowpipe couldn't. As soon as they say that there's a window on the plane, and then you're like a little bit like, so why didn't they get rid of the blowpipe? And then you think, okay, so that's a red herring too. But I don't think, I definitely didn't get that. Oh my God, Xander, that's so cool. And then, so did you realize that the daughter was the lady's maid?
Not necessarily. I kind of figured something, because again, it's kind of similar to what she's done before. But I think because the wasp was on the cover of the book, and then as soon as the wasp kept coming up, I knew it was a false lead. I don't know. The dentist coat, it just stuck out so much to me. Funnily enough, the one I was, you know, least enjoying, I figured it out.
Well, maybe that's why, because actually your brain free. Like, you were not as emotionally engaged, so your brain was more free to kind of start detecting. It is quite ingenious. And I do like the way she's sort of a little bit taking the piss out of outlandish murder plots. You know, yes, we'll have a blowpipe and a rare Amazonian, you know, it's the sort of thing that if you were like 11 and trying to like write a murder mystery, you'd come up with something like completely outlandish like that.
Well, I mean, she says as much when Inspector Japp is saying, you know, talking about the one writer dude who's so excited because, like, he wrote a book where the whole mystery was the blowpipe and the fingerprints. And, you know, like, it's just like these people to write these insane novels. And then she goes on to have just, like, the most ridiculous mortuary court scene ever, you know?
I figured that Clancy was being set up. So, like, I thought it would come out that the murderer had read his book, knew he would be on the plane, like, that kind of thing. And then I probably should have guessed that there was something up with Norman Gale, because I could tell that Poirot was trying to set up Jane and the DuPont boy. So I knew there was something, you know, Poirot's a romantic at heart. Yeah, he's more of a romantic than a detective. Yeah.
He wants good people.
Let me give you a secret. Nobody just gives up their winnings on a gambling table.
I mean, I could see if you're really wealthy and it's a small sum, like,
and she's a really hot chick, you want to impress her. I don't know, but it's funny, like in a lot of Agatha Christie books, that the men who are really good looking are not to be trusted. And I think it literally comes from her first marriage. Like, she had so many proposals. I think she had 3 marriage proposals before she accepted Archibald Christie. And she accepted him because he was this dashing RAF pilot, and he was very tanned and tall and gorgeous. And he ended up just being a shitbag, right? A cheating scumbag. And then she married this kind of like very plain, like sensible archaeologist. And I think she sort of, you always sometimes have these very dashing men, these bronze men. And when you see Gladys saying, well, you could have just got the suntan out of a bottle, I think that's very much Agatha Christie saying, don't trust everything with these really like good looking Adonis types. They're not always everything crack up to be, for sure.
Not all that glitters is gold.
Yeah. Well, then she did end up with like a nice younger man. So she didn't do too badly, right? I think the solution is quite clever.
I have an anecdote about that.
Oh, go for it.
So shortly after Christie's second marriage to Sir Max Mallowan.
Yep.
So in chapter 13, Poirot says, imagine a hotel in Syria. There was an English man whose wife had taken ill and he had to be in Iraq himself. So he left his wife and went on so as to be on duty on time. And the doctor thought it quite natural, but the Syrian doctor thought it barbaric. So this actually happened to Christie and her husband shortly after they were married. This is an anecdote taken from their real life.
Yeah. So he abandoned her when she was sick to go and fulfill an obligation. I reckon Philip would do that to me as well. Like, there's something like so English about that. Like, I can't possibly let people down when I've made a commitment, even though I'd be like prostrate in the bed, like puking my guts out.
No, I feel like if you know it, you're going to recover, you know, it's like, what good is it? Go on, you know?
Yeah.
It, obviously, if you were actually on your deathbed, probably it would change it. But
and actually, the novel we're coming to after ABC Murders is Murder in Mesopotamia, which is set on an archaeological dig. And we're going to get a lot of little good Agatha Christie, Max Mallowan stuff woven into that for sure.
Thanks.
Yeah.
There's also a reference to Murder on the Links in this book.
Yep. The Inspector Fourier.
Yeah. References Monsieur Girard in chapter 6.
Yeah.
Those are the ones I caught. And then obviously the Murder on the Orient Express one that you already mentioned.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like they could all have done it. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that's pretty much everything we have to say on this one, listener. I still think it's quite a tricksy solution, I have to say. I do like it. And Xander, you'll be pleased to know that at the time, loads and loads of people wrote into Agatha Christie and said, you got the Amazonian blowpipe totally wrong. In reality, those blowpipes are like 6 foot long. They're not these short little ones that you can tuck into.
Oh, yeah. And then doesn't she she addresses it in one of her later books.
Yeah, so when she
takes the piss of herself.
Yeah, so she then invents the character of Ariadne Oliver. He's a detective novelist. And Ariadne Oliver, I think it's in Mrs. McGinty's Dead, says, oh my God, this one time I made up the story with this blowpipe and everyone wrote into me because I got it wrong. Oh God. You know, like, so.
Yeah.
Which is quite like meta Christie verse.
Just sure. Her way of saying that's really nerds.
Nerd.
That's sort of like the equivalent now of like, you know, when people break the fourth wall or have a blooper reel out and you feel like you're in on it, kind of like, I think that's great for fans.
Yeah. And that's what I love about as we're getting now into like the second decade of the novels, you really do feel like you're part of this quite intimate, friendly Christie verse and that there are lots of hints and lots of cross references. And, you know, we're definitely having a bunch of fun at this point. Yeah. Although I do think the tone becomes more sinister and darker in the next one. And I think this was a nice bit of froth, a nice bit of, you know, rich 1935 froth before we get to
the next is ABC, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know,
ABC is in my top five.
But yeah, I think Xander, from my perspective, we're now shifting even into a higher gear. So you get this one. Yeah, we're going to get ABC Murders. And actually, even Murder in Mesopotamia is pretty good. But then we're going to get Cards on the Table, which a lot of people think is an absolute classic. Then we're going to get Death.
Never read that one. I've never read either of those, so I'm excited for that.
And then we're going to get Death on the Nile, which people think are an absolute classic. Well, that's my all-time favorite. And then Appointment with Death, which is absolutely a humdinger. So between like ABC Murders in 1936 and Appointment with Death 1938, so it's only 2 years. And then we get And Then There Were None 1939. So these are like absolute cold stone.
Yeah, the golden age.
Flipping classics. Like, yeah. This is just it.
I am really glad that you enjoyed the radio play, though, as much as I do. I think John Moffat's Poirot is class.
Just like, absolutely
classic.
Yeah.
And the jazz, like, every now and again, the jazz interludes, because those were, like, at commercial breaks, basically. So every now and again, it's a little jarring, because you have, like, particularly, I think, Peril at End House, or maybe it's Three Act Tragedy, goes from like a pretty macabre scene and like a very serious scene, and then it's like da 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 da, like kind of jazz music segueing out of it. So it can be a little jarring, but for the most part, I just think they're so well done.
Is John Moffat has quite a soft accent, and I think sometimes people play Hercule Poirot so bombastic. Kenneth Branagh does that in particular, and I kind of prefer the John Malkovich, the John Moffat style softer Poirot's, because I think he knows he's clever. Like, he doesn't need to shout about it. I mean, he does sometimes make these zingers, that are quite arrogant. But in general, he's quite unassuming. In general, he usually says stuff like, well, you know, I've read the list of what's in the briefcases and I think I've figured it out, but I just need to test a few ideas. But,
right.
you know, he carries himself it's actually so subtle, in a soft way, you know?
But it has this huge presence too. Like it's so natural and he really paints the character well, the way he vocalizes things. Like I really can see it in the radio plays and I enjoy them immensely.
Anyway, my gorgeous friendly Christie-verse friends, this is just a joy. So even on a book that I didn't enjoy that much, it didn't matter because I knew I was going to have fun talking about it with you guys. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm Sansa, really grateful to be included in this. It's given me a new vigor for Vok.
Oh, well, I'm so happy.
I mean, has been a hell of a lot of fun with two of my favorite people. And absolutely been the most amount of books I've read in 6 months or something and years, you know.
Well,
it's fun and it's manageable because they're short, you know.
Yeah. So I really look forward to these little catch-ups. So Xander, raise the flag of Vok when you feel you're kind of getting towards the end of ABC, and I'll do a reread and we'll reconvene. But in the meantime, I love you all and I love this is just a bunch of fun. So thank you.